Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Let's get started, shall we?
Motor Talk with Toby Hagen.
Toby, good evening. Welcome back to Nightlife.
Thank you.
Good to see you. Now, March vehicle sales figures. The story for Holden gets worse and worse. This once mighty motor car firm has, well, it's not even on its knees. It may be lower than that.
Yeah, look, it's certainly an extremely challenging start to the year for Holden. Mm. Sales in March down 29%. So in February.
In one month,
yeah. So in February, the sales were the record low sales since the first Holden rod off the production line in 1948, their worst monthly sales. That sort of got a fraction worse in March because it wasn't their worst overall sales, but it was their worst market share, 4.8%. So, as I said, very challenging start, and they have a heck of a lot of work to do.
Yeah, they sure do. Toyota's again top of the pops.
Yeah, top brand again. Although interestingly, their sales did drop a bit. It's been an interesting month. Well, March is always an interesting month for Japanese car makers generally because it's the end of the Japanese financial year. So you see some of them try and push pretty hard across the line and have a big sales push. But yeah, Toyota was down a fraction, but still extremely dominant in that number one position and not looking like going anywhere soon. So they're rolling along pretty nicely.
SUVs and Utes are still the top of the market,
are
they?
Not top of the market. Mid-sized SUVs will soon be the single biggest segment if the trend that we've seen going continues. Mm-hmm. Small cars are actually still the biggest single market segment.
Okay.
Just ahead of those mid-sized SUVs. But look, yeah, certainly enormous growth in SUVs. The small SUVs up 33% for March. Mid-sized SUVs up 10%. And Utes just continue to go gangbusters. And there's been a lot of Ute action, which we will touch on later. But the Utes are generally, it's an extremely strong market at the moment.
Yeah, what's the way back for Holden? I mean, it's not entirely clear, is it?
Oh, I think partly it's going back to basics, getting the basics right, and I think they should probably try and push their strengths, which is the history and heritage and knowledge of the Australian market. But look, they've got to get the basics right. They've got to get the marketing right. You could argue that hasn't been right recently.
Have they got the products?
They've got some of the products. They maybe don't have them nailed to exactly what they want. And an example of that would be the Equinox mid-sized SUV that has been on sale 5 or 6 months, something like that. It's a very good car in a lot of ways.
But you've had a driver this.
I'm driving one today. I've had a driver one. There's a lot going for it. But things like the base model, for example, don't get autonomous emergency braking, which you've got to pay extra for it, which in rival cars, Mazda CX-5, Volkswagen Tiguan, those features come standard, and they're sort of fairly big ticket safety items. So there's little things like that. I think they've got to push to really, take good product and make them fantastic product. And there's a lot of steps to the process. Fixing the current predicament they're in, it's not going to happen in a month or two. It's not going to happen in a year or two. This is a long-term plan. So they need to get the strategy right and move on with it.
Mm. Yeah, that's the thing. As you and I were talking off air before we came on here, the lead times in the motor car business are long.
And that's exactly right.
You make decisions which you don't really see the fruits of for 5 or 6 years.
And you don't pay the price for any incorrect decisions for years. And this is something post-GFC, that was an incredible thing we started seeing happening. The car companies that really slashed their research and development budgets, it didn't hurt them for that year or two or three after the GFC. It hurt them 4 or 5 years after the GFC when the cars that were supposed to be coming either didn't come or the cars arrived underdone. So we saw that with Honda in particular. There were quite a few brands where that really hurt them later on. So as you can imagine in a car company, for Bean Counter, for example, an accountant is under a lot of pressure and they say, how am I going to fix this? Okay, we'll slash that, and that. He looks great because he slashed the costs and he doesn't pay the price, or the company doesn't pay the price for potentially years to come. So it's there's a bit of that going on at Holden. Absolutely. They're paying the price for some poor decisions that were made previously.
Meanwhile, you say Toyota has, although they don't make anything here anymore, they've retained a fair presence in design and some local manufacturing as well.
They have, yeah. Nothing like Ford and Holden. So if you look at Ford, for example, it's got about 1,000 people here doing all sorts of work, ground-up cars. So they're doing the remake of the Bronco, which will obviously be a big car in America, expected to sell in Australia as well. So they're heavily involved in that car. They did the current Ford Ranger, the Ford Everest. So Ford has got some massive talent going on and as I said, a very big team. Holden's also got some of the best designers in the business. They have a very strong team of a few hundred people down there in terms of people doing vehicle evaluation, engineers, designers, and so on. Toyota has a smaller presence, but they do have a design presence, and they've given us an insight into that recently with about 150-odd people. And the first car, or one of the cars that we'll see a bit of an example of that of, is an update to the Hilux Ute, which is coming in the next few months, and they've got a few different variants. So the basic car is the same, but in Australia, they've created these effectively, what we could call update kits for them. So a new model within that Hilux range that's got all these additional features on there, and that is a product of Australia. So you sort of might think, okay, things like bumpers and minor changes like that are not really a big deal, but the effort that goes into those to make sure they live up to the standards that are requested by the head offices and also they're wanted by punters, by people about to buy the cars, there's an enormous amount of research and stuff goes in there. So, yeah.
Let's just, while we're on this topic, actually, just take a couple of text calls here. Andy in Canberra says, Toby, I'm a very rare person, a car buyer looking for a new sedan.
Wow.
I know. Andy, we'll give out your address and that's right. Bring your truckload. I'm looking for a new sedan, and I've got it down to the Holden Commodore RS versus the Ford Mondeo Trend.
Mm-hmm.
Both in the high 30s, drive away. Can't find any comparisons online. Leaning to the Ford, but the extra warranty in the Holden's tempting. Would love an opinion. If I went to Holden, is it worth the extra for the V6 all-wheel drive?
You've got two good engine choices in that Holden, being the front drive turbocharged petrol engine. You can also get a diesel, but let's stick to petrol for this comparison. So front drive turbo petrol four-cylinder or the V6, which only comes with all-wheel drive. The all-wheel drive system is a fantastic all-wheel drive system. It's one of the cleverest systems out there in terms of how it diverts the power and preempts when it's going to need to send drive to the rear wheels. But I'd probably only go for it if you're planning on doing either some fairly sporty driving, you really enjoy your driving, or if you're going to be doing gravel roads and a lot of wet roads. I guess you can't pick that, but those sorts of things. So I'd be more than happy with that four-cylinder turbo. Very strong engine in it. In terms of choosing between the two, if it was my choice, I would go, well, the Holden, I think, is a nicer drive than the Mondeo. It's certainly a fresher vehicle. As you mentioned, at the moment, they're doing some pretty sharp deals on warranties. So that'd be my pick. The other one I'd throw into the mix, and this may be a little bit dull for someone when I mention the name, but it is a really nice car, and that's Toyota Camry. So the latest Camry, imported Camry, is a huge step up and a lot less Camry-like than the previous Camrys we've seen. So it's also worth a look.
You were never going to buy a Camry to get excited, were you?
No, and this is something they're trying to change. And this latest car, as I said, it's a big step up. It's worth just popping into the dealership to at least take it around the block and say, okay, no, it's not for me, or yes, I'll stick it on the shortlist. So... they're the options. But as I said, I'd probably go the Holden. As I said, a nicer drive and a newer model. And it's
Thanks for that. Hope that helps, Andy. John, we were going to talk about Mercedes too, but John wants to know your thoughts on the new Mercedes C200. I appear to have good deals on them at the present. Are they worth the money, or should I wait for the update?
Well, I haven't driven the update yet, but the update is a significant change from where the C-Class has been. So the current C-Class is a fine luxury vehicle. It's a top-selling luxury car in the country. C200 is, if it'd be C200 or 250, would be the most popular variant there. The things I like about C-Class, the interior is terrific. It's a comfortable, easy car to live with. The engine is nothing exciting. The 250 engine is certainly a better engine, but it's a good engine. The big change that's coming with the updated version that I think is about July, somewhere around then, Is the drivetrain in it. So it's going to a standard mild hybrid system. So it'll have, I think it's a 10 or 12 kilowatt electric motor hooked up to a 1.5 litre four-cylinder turbocharged engine. So it's going to use a fair bit less fuel than the previous one and give you slightly better performance. So as I said, I haven't driven it on paper. It looks like it's promising a fair bit. So I would, if you're not in a hurry, I would certainly wait until we start to see what they're like to drive in terms of reading reviews and so on, or at least get a chance to drive one yourself, by which time I would imagine you'd still be able to get one of the old ones. They usually sort of have an overlap there, so hopefully there will be.
Yeah. Speaking of Mercedes-Benz, the sub-brand, the performance brand AMG, is doing pretty well too. More than 10% of Mercedes-Benz sales.
Oh, it's rocketing along, yeah. So
people want a bit of badge, do they?
Oh, people love the sound, the performance. Yeah. The odd thing with Australia is we have one of the highest take-up rates of performance versions of cars in the world. So the world is actually, car makers actually, AMG, for example, the boss of AMG, Tobias Moores, he loves Aussies because...
Who actually is AMG? I mean, the cars are Mercedes-Benz cars.
The cars are Mercedes-Benz.
And AMG is a company what are they?
Hot it up. Effectively. And so Tobias is he's almost like... How could you describe it? He's an extreme enthusiast who loves to do a burnout now and again and has a bit of fun.
Do Mercedes like the fact that AMG are hotting up their cars?
Oh, they love it. So AMG is owned by Mercedes-Benz. Oh, okay. It didn't used to be. So I think this year's the 50th anniversary of AMG. Mm. So it started as an independent tuner. Then Mercedes-Benz bought into it, into a share. And it was around the mid-90s they bought the company out wholly, and now they own it. And so they run it as very much a separate business. And that has worked extremely well for them, to the point where, as you say, their sales are now extremely strong. They have a very good reputation. They've muscled in on the market that may have been sort of Maserati or Jaguar level previously, and they've sort of come in and just gone, bang, here we go. We're going to be part of this as well. So it's working pretty well. They now do. So the brand was really built on, in the 90s and 2000s, built on V8 engines, and they still do them, and they're standout engines. But now they're doing.
When you get an AMG car, you get more exhaust pipes, I've noticed.
You get four, yeah. So you get plenty of exhausts. And look, they do, in all honesty. So I've driven, in the turbocharged era, these days almost every car that comes out of particularly Europe has got turbochargers to try and help meet the latest emission standards. Mm-hmm. And it tends to muffle the engine sound. So particularly with a V8, you go from suddenly having this sensational sounding car. A 458 Ferrari, for example, one of the best sounds you'll ever hear on any car. The 488 that replaced it, better performance, turbochargers, and doesn't sound nearly as good. So Ferrari has done an okay job with V8 turbo engine sounds. They haven't done a terrific job. Audi's similar, BMW's the same, Maserati's the same. You then go to AMG, and they have got as close to nailing it as you'll get. They're still not quite there. As I said, they work so hard on that engine sound. Part of it's the exhausts. Although interesting,
actually, tell us about that, because the sound you can't really fundamentally alter it, can you?
You can with tuning the exhaust. Well,
So it's the length of the exhaust pipe, because I mean that's making the noise and the resonance in the pipe.
Absolutely, the length. It's also so you'll hear anyone who owns an Audi or a Volkswagen, for example, you can put them in sport mode, and when you change gear and you're sort of getting on it, it'll let out this little brap as you change gears, and it's actually just throwing a bit more fuel in as it changes gears. So it actually uses a fraction of fuel doing it, but it's all to sound just that little bit better, just to peak the sound. Car makers spend an enormous amount of effort on the sound of their engines. Not all of them, obviously. The bottom end of the market, not so much. But those top-end brands, they're all pouring big money into trying to make the sound superb. Like, they're just trying to get it there. Lexus was one. Throughout the 1990s, Lexus had worked out how to dull down. They made their cars so quiet and so refined, you had no idea what was under the bonnet. And since then, they've gone exact opposite. They're now building engine sound. They're building a V8 sound into their cars so that people get that sensation.
I wonder what performance electric cars are going to do about this, because they don't make a noise at all.
They don't make a noise at all. And all the car makers are trying to work out what to do with
it. I mean, these $250,000 Teslas, they don't make any noise.
No, they make a very, very mild noise. It's sort of an electric motor type noise. You imagine a train leaving the station, you just hear a little bit of that noise. So, they make it worse. So, but Aston Martin, for example, I was chatting to the boss of him recently about exactly this, and he said in the development of their moving towards electric cars, he said, we're not worried about battery technology. I'm going to outsource the batteries because I don't want to be developing cells and so on. But he said the electric motors are going to be the heart of the car. And as a performance brand, we have to control that heart of the car. So all the companies are trying to work out how to do it. AMG is one that says with electric sound, we would prefer not to do a fake sound. Now, they might amplify the electric sound that's there, but they're all saying they can get slightly different characters out of an electric motor. That said, you're not going to get anything like the character that you can get out of a petrol engine.
No, because a motor, there's no exhaust, and a motor doesn't make, an electric motor doesn't really make any noise.
No, it doesn't make, I mean, it doesn't make anything like the noise of other cars. I mean, look, there's a race series called Formula E, so it's sort of a rival to Formula One with fully electric cars. Mm. They look similar to a Formula One car in terms of open wheeler, but they don't have anything like the sound of even a modern F1 car, let alone the ones that sounded great 5 or 6 years ago.
You know what they're going to have to do, Toby? This is a crazy idea, I know, but they're going to have to team up with composers.
Yeah. Put fake sounds.
AMG.
Yeah. Right. Well, they are. So these days,
AMG, the only one that has the Spice Girls.
Well, artificial engine sounds are now relatively common on some performance cars. So Ford, BMW, Mercedes-Benz, others use some fake engine sound, and they do that by pumping it through the speakers in the car. Cool. So you can't hear that it's, you don't necessarily know it's a fake sound, but it just sort of amplifies ever so slightly the sound that the car's making. So
now, Toby, we said we'd talk about Tesla. They're struggling a bit. They're building cars, but not fast enough.
Not enough, no. So they've got an issue with the Model 3. This is their mainstream car, the car to go up against that Mercedes-Benz C-Class we were talking about earlier, BMW 3 Series, Audi A4. It's the real heartland of the luxury market, so they need to build a lot of them. This is the car they said they had about 400,000 orders for globally. They wanted to be building 5,000 cars a week. They're building nothing like that. So I think they built around 2,000 in 1 week, which was and that was fairly recently. Mm-hmm. So all this issue means that they suddenly don't have the cash flow coming in that they would be getting by selling those cars. So and they're still spending a lot of money trying to ramp up their production lines and so on. So Goldman Sachs, for example, has warned against the stock price and said they think their stock price is going to go down and that they are going to need to do another capital raising exercise later this year, which a lot of people have been saying for a while. So, yeah, the company is... Well, it's not in good health.
They might be running into the problems that a lot of companies like that run into, which is that they just burn cash at such a rate that they run out of money.
Yeah, well, manufacturing cars, which are an extremely complex item, manufacturing them in a high volume is a very challenging thing. And look, we've seen, you know, all the rumours about Apple at one stage looking to build a car. They seem to have fizzled out. Google was allegedly going to build a car at one stage. They seem to have walked away from it, effectively finding that this is a very complex exercise and the margins are very low, and you need a lot of experience and skill to make it happen. So, and I think Tesla might be learning that now. They've had issues with quality in the past, massive issues with quality. They still have issues with quality these days. So the cars aren't necessarily up to the same quality levels of others. That said, they have a very unique selling proposition, which is that they're very high performance and sexy electric cars.
You haven't driven this Tesla 3 yet, have you?
Haven't driven the
you
Model 3.
You haven't driven it in the States,
no. I've driven the Model S and the Model X, the other two cars they've got, but haven't driven the Model 3. It was supposed to be, they were talking...
It's out in the States, isn't it?
It's out in the States, yeah. They've started delivering...
There are people driving around in the States.
In America. And there's... they were initially hoping it could come to Australia later this year. It's very clear that's now not going to happen. 2019 at best... I would suggest we're probably looking at more like 2020. So it's so it's a fair way off. And if you look at that, by 2020, there are going to be a lot of other car makers offering electric cars. We've got Jaguar in the next, or by the end of this year, Jaguar will have its first electric car on sale. And the Germans are closely following. So there's a lot of action happening in that market, and suddenly the competition will ramp up.
Yeah, I was on my motorcycle following a little BMW electric car the other day.
Yeah, I mean, i3 or something.
The i3, yeah. I mean, you know, you and I have talked, you don't see the electric cars around much, but just ever since that conversation, I've started...
You notice them.
I've started to notice a few more, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, they're getting around, and it's, it'll be a slow burn. It'll be an extremely slow burn in Australia, but it will start happening.
Wayne, hello.
Oh, hi, Philip and Toby. I'm just having a bit of a hunt around for a car for my 18-year-old daughter, and there's a few Mazda 3s and Ford Focus from around 2004 in that sort of $5,000 to $7,000 category that, you know, have a bit of safety and reliability about them.
Yep.
But I've been surprised that there's a lot of Peugeot 307s in that range that seem to have a bit more safety in them. Do you have any comment on sort of reliability and repairs and things on those?
Yeah, so reliability is not going to be as good as the... Well, history would suggest that reliability will not be as good as the Japanese and the Asian brands generally.
Mm-hmm.
And when something does go bang, it will cost you a lot. So be careful. That's why those cars are selling relatively affordably.
Okay.
So it's not to say you can't get lucky and get a great one and it goes on forever and ever, but you are potentially buying a car that could cost you a lot. So automatic transmissions, for example, could be big issues on some of those French cars of that era. And fit and finish wasn't always great. Electrical problems are another one. So, and all those things are fairly expensive things to fix. So you're not talking about a grand or two. You're talking about many thousands of dollars. So it's something to be aware of.
Sure.
And the other thing is, are you looking at an automatic rather than a manual?
Yes.
Yeah. So the automatic transmissions of that era of French car were very ordinary to drive. So they the engines tended to be not particularly powerful, and they things like shift quality and what gear it was in were never quite right. So they just didn't quite live up to what they should be. The one comment I'd make too, if you can, and you might struggle for the $5,000 to $7,000, but if you can tip in another grand or two, you'll definitely get there, which is that the around that time, 2004-05, front airbags were very common around then. So almost everything you're looking at will have dual front airbags. And you'll have ABS brakes. I don't think you'll be finding stability control in many of the cars at that level. But side curtain airbags were starting to get a little bit popular around then. Now, they only would have been on the top-end versions of those cars. If you can stretch it to 2007 or 8, somewhere around there, 2009, you'll start noticing those side airbags a lot more often on the car. So if you want to know how to spot them, look on the A pillar, so the pillar either side of the front windscreen, and you'll see a little mark saying SRS. It'll either say SRS or airbag, and that'll tell you that it's got the side airbag. So,
okay, yeah, no, that sort is comforting to know about the airbags when you're putting an 18-year-old in the car, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's it's just one little thing. I mean, they are genuinely lifesavers in a side impact. So it's good thing to have there.
Mm. Good luck.
Terrific.
Good luck.
Thank
with
you.
The work. Can she drive yet?
No, still doing your hours.
Yeah. All right, Wayne, I know the anxiety. I haven't been through it.
See you, all right, mate. Thanks,
bye-bye. Bye-bye. Paul says, Toby, when's the 300 series Land Cruiser due in Australia?
that's what it's going to be called. So we've currently obviously got 200 series as well as the retro style or the older version, the 70 series. Look, I've been pushing Toyota on this for years, and logic would suggest it would have been about now. The 200 series came out in 2008. They tend to go for around 10 years, so you would have thought it would be around now. We haven't heard anything, and we haven't even seen spy photos and so on, which is sort of the indicator that they might be getting ready to do one.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm actually not expecting anything in the next probably 2 years in terms of Land Cruiser 200 series. That said, they might surprise us, and next year or 2020, one might pop out. But the problem is that a car like that is a massive investment. It's not a very high-volume car globally. So it's a very popular car in Australia. It's popular in the Middle East, and it's popular a little bit in America. They're not popular in Asia, and they're not popular in Europe. So
they're not popular in what? In the US because they're not big enough, is that?
They are popular in the US. They're not. So, they've got a thing called the Sequoia, which is
their bigger. I've
Land Cruiser X.
Land Cruiser on massive steroids.
So, it's the next level up. So, you still see Land Cruisers around. It's a decent market for them. Australia's the single biggest market for Land Cruiser in the world.
Yeah.
So, we have
once you get outside the city, Land Cruiser.
Oh, they're everywhere, yeah.
It's the car that built Australia.
Well, yeah. And any time you see the 80 series, so the late 80s, early 90s ones, you see 100 series, you see an amazing array of Land Cruisers that are still going. And those 80 series are loved. The owners who own them now just love them, and they still sell for reasonable money, and 100 series are the same. So they've got a pretty strong following, but as I said, I haven't heard anything. I can't get anything out of Toyota. I've been pushing whoever I can for years trying to work it out when it might be here.
Yep.
But, given we haven't heard the noise that you normally hear, I'm not expecting anything in the short term.
Mm. Okay, there's your answer. There's your answer, Paul. Don't die waiting. Jacqueline, hello.
G'day.
Hi.
How are you going?
Yeah, good,
Hi,
Jack.
Toby.
Hi.
I've just got a question about a Volkswagen Golf.
Yep.
2016 model.
Yep.
I keep hearing on the grapevine all of these things about taking out extended warranties and things for DSGs because if they go or there's a problem. Obviously, listening to you talk about the Peugeot before, it can be quite expensive to fix.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering what your view is on that sort of range and, you know, whether it's, you know, you buy these cars in good faith and they are excellent cars, but you know, is it something that you don't want to let it get too old or...
How long are you looking to hold another car roughly?
Like 5 years.
Yeah, I wouldn't be too concerned with that. And the reason is, so Volkswagen copped a lot of negative press a few years ago in regards to the DSGs, and they had a lot of DSG failures. They have since changed their customer service, their after-sales customer service, quite substantially. They've also changed components within that DSG gearbox to try and make it more reliable. So obviously, I guess time will tell if they do start lasting. And things like you've also got Australian consumer law backup. So if a major component like a transmission, an engine, something that's going to cost many thousands and would generally be expected to last well beyond the 3 year warranty time, then you will. The expectation from the ACCC is that there will at least be a contribution to fixes and so on. So I think what we're hearing now is we're hearing far fewer issues with DSGs in terms of failures. And I think with all those other factors, I wouldn't be too concerned. The other thing to keep in mind with extended warranties is there's a very big difference between a factory-backed extended warranty and a dealer extended warranty. So the dealer extended warranties can have some pretty laborious clauses in there and requirements to service it at that dealership and so on to make sure that you don't break that extra warranty you've got. Whereas a factory warranty, you won't have any of those issues. You could sell it with the car, those sorts of things. So any additional warranty, look at the fine print very carefully. But in your case, I wouldn't be too stressed about it. I think you'll find that the car should be okay. And as I said, if it isn't, I think either Volkswagen will come to the party voluntarily or you'll have the ACCC to help back you up.
Great. And anything to look out for in terms of the transmission, like that it could be on the turn?
So shunting sometimes not taking off nearly as smoothly as they did previously, not changing gears as smoothly. So one of the things you'll notice once a DSG gets going, once the car's moving, it's almost imperceptible when the thing changes gears. So you can hear the engine and you see the revs change, but you don't necessarily feel anything with the car. So they're very, very smooth on the change. So if that starts getting rough, if you start finding it struggling to select, drive and reverse, and if it does some shunting off the line, then any of those are warning signs that something starting to go wrong. But keep in mind, as anyone who's driven a DSG may have experienced, they are sometimes laggy off the line. So when you go to first take off, they're not necessarily as smooth as a regular auto. That is an inherent issue with the transmission, and it's the basic design of it. But don't be worried about that. Just get used to driving around that. But the other ones are the issue.
Mm.
Yeah, right. Thanks so much.
Okay, Jack. Good on you. Thank you. Jacqueline where are we? Dum-dum-dum-dum. Hi, it's Lisa. Extended warranties on second-hand vehicles at a dealership. Are the extended vehicle warranties offered for purchase worth the price tag?
This is again one of those ones you need to go and look at the fine print. So if it says things like you must do additional servicing, put all these additional cleaners and everything through the engine, only get it serviced with us, all those sorts of things, then be very, very, very careful because they can often sting you for big money. The other thing is they'll often have a lot of exclusions in there. They'll often put a charge on if something major fails. It'll be an extra grand or two as sort of an excess to get it fixed. So be aware of all those things. Go through the fine print very carefully. I mean, ultimately, it's obviously a contract that you're signing, so you're trying to make sure that you're getting the right contract for you.
Lisa says, she goes on to say, would you recommend a particular insurer such as Allianz, or alternatively, Is it safer to purchase a prestige vehicle from a branded dealer such as Audi with the extended warranty included in the price of the vehicle? I'm looking at an Audi Q3, the 2014-15.
Yeah, so what you found with particularly the premium manufacturers, any brand wants their cars to be worth something after a few years. High resale values are good for the brand.
Yeah.
So the premium brands in particular have got these programs where they will bring a car back in and do a fairly thorough check of it to make sure it hasn't got any issues. If there are issues, they'll fix it up and then sell it with their extra warranty. So it's a little bit different with them. When they're throwing it in there, they're sort of giving you a guarantee of, hey, we've had a look at this car. We know it's been serviced. We think it's going to hang together pretty well, so we'll throw this warranty in. So that's probably a little bit different when you've got the backing of effectively the factory there. It's the ones that are more or less an insurance policy and they have a lot of exclusions. They're the ones that you've got to be a bit careful of.
Mm. Okay. All right. What else have we got here? May from Burnley says, I'm interested in the Nissan Cube.
Yeah.
Wanting your opinion on them, please. And if any sold new in Australia, wanting to know why there aren't new ones available.
So Nissan Cube was only ever a private import into the country. So they came in as out of Japan.
Uh-huh.
I've only ever driven one briefly in Japan. It drives well enough. It's reasonable. Any of those grey imports, a couple of things to keep in mind. Ring an insurance company first and get a quote on insurance, because sometimes some insurance companies aren't too keen on them because it is difficult to get parts. So if you have a crash, you can write the car off pretty easily, even if it's a minor crash, because getting the parts can be a challenge. And also be aware that getting parts, you're not going to be able to get them at your Nissan dealer because they don't carry...
When you say it was a private import, imported by who?
So there are companies that...
imported them.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it can be individual people, but yeah. There are companies that specialise in that sort of stuff. So they'll go to Japan and they'll often buy so in Japan, a car that's more than 10 years old is very, very expensive to register. So if a car gets to 7 or 8 years old or 6 years old, they might end up just sending it off to somewhere like Australia where they can get some decent money for it rather than have it effectively run out of its life.
Is this what May's talking about when she says I can't seem to find any new ones?
No, they never did a new one in Australia. So it wasn't imported by Nissan. They were never sold here by Nissan.
Okay.
So, and this sort of thing's a frustration for Nissan dealers and all the other brands, because people buy them secondhand off someone else and they then take them into a Nissan dealer and say, fix this. And the dealer says, we don't have parts. So it's so all those grey imports, you have to be a bit careful. So it's not to say that the car itself was fine as a new car. It's just that you're not going to have the backup and support that you would elsewhere. Now, that said, a Nissan Cube is a fairly common car. So there would be companies in Australia, those smaller companies, ensuring that the commonly replaced parts are available. So it's not like you
won't get them. Its main attraction is its cute little shoebox shape, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, yeah. It was a very distinctively styled car, asymmetric tailgate on it and so on. So it's, it was a cool little thing, very spacious inside, and it was and that was one of the things, a lot of headroom and so on, so yeah, it was pretty cool. But
Peter from Brizzy, hi Pete, says, hello, is Ford having trouble selling the Mustang now that they're offering a 5-year warranty and 3-year free servicing?
No is the short story. So Mustang is the second best-selling Ford on the market, believe it or not.
There you go.
The top one by a long shot is Ranger.
Is there Ranger?
Last month, Ranger accounted for 61% of Ford sales. So almost 2 in every 3 cars that leave a Ford dealer is a Ranger. So extremely popular car.
Who would have predicted that?
Oh, I know. And who would have predicted that Mustang would be number 2? And, I mean, not even Ford realised how popular Mustang would be in Australia. They sell up to 700 a month.
Wow.
So it's a massive number. When you consider your average sports car, they're usually happy if they sell 20 or 30 or 40 a month. So to sell 700, it's the top-selling sports car in the country.
Is it worth it?
It's a good car. I wouldn't bother with the 4-cylinder, mainly because the 4-cylinder engine's actually a nice engine, but you're buying a Mustang, you're buying a muscle car, it's got to sound good. So we go back to the sound thing. It's okay, it's not the best driving thing in the world, but it does what it says on the box. It makes a good sound, it looks cool, and it's reasonable to drive. So in terms of the warranty, I would imagine that is only on the current Mustang. So there's an updated Mustang coming in the next few months. It's going to have a 10-speed automatic transmission, it's going to have an updated V8 engine and some mild styling changes. Still the same basic body, but they're tweaking the look of it. So I would think that would just be an incentive to try and clear some stock that's here now. So be aware of that new one coming.
All right. Pam from Brisbane says, a suggested vehicle for seniors, $40,000?
Wow, it depends on what size you want.
It's a pretty big question, isn't it?
Yeah, look, okay, let's go back to if we're
looking at performance vehicles.
Not looking at performance necessarily, although you can buy a Golf GDI or something, that's a bit of fun.
Yeah, yeah.
But look, getting back to those the Camrys that I touched on earlier, I think that'd be a terrific car for that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
If you're doing around town driving, suburban driving, the hybrid version, the hybrid engine in that is not only great value, it'll almost halve your fuel bill. So it's pretty good buying. If you want to look at something like an SUV, something like a Mazda CX-5 would do a nice job. So there's a couple of options to go and have a look at. But there's so many. I mean, in that 40 grand market you're playing in, you've got every choice from SUVs to sedans to entry-level hot hatches to
it's a broad question, isn't it?
Depends
on what you're actually looking for. Hi, Sally.
Oh, hi. Yes, I sold my house to get some money to do different things, and one was buying a car.
Yep.
And I'm wondering what you think of. I think it's Honda. It's the Honda Jazz.
Yep.
What do you think of that car?
Look, the Jazz is so of those so-called city cars, the Jazz is one of the more spacious ones in that segment. So it is it has some very clever folding back seats that can open it up into a mini wagonette type of thing if you need to carry push bikes or whatever else. It's a decent driving car, and yeah, they've done a really nice job with that latest one. Some other cars, if space is not quite as important to you, a Mazda 2 would be worth a look, and also as a left fielder, a Kia Rio, which comes with a 7-year warranty, and it's a pretty good thing. And another left fielder is Suzuki Swift. So that latest Suzuki Swift is a really good fun car to drive, well packaged, well priced, and yeah, built to last. It's good.
And can you drive the Honda Jazz interstate?
You can drive any of them interstate, yeah. So
how will they go on the freeway? Yeah, yeah.
They'll be fine. So most of these, even these city cars these days, not the base model versions of them, but the next one. So in a Jazz, for example, it's VTIL. We'll have cruise control. I haven't got it around. I don't know exactly which ones don't have cruise and which ones do, but cruise control is becoming more common in that end of the market. So they'll happily sit on 100 or 110 k's an hour. They will not have an issue with it at all. They'll all get up there pretty easily. Some hills, if you've got two or three people in the car and you reach a steep hill, you might be flat on the accelerator for a while getting it to go up, but they'll still do it fine. They're all actually quite decent cars for driving interstate. They'll sit on the freeway nicely.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, cool. Good on you, Sally, and good luck with it. Speaking of warranties, Toby, the whole warranty competition is getting pretty hot, isn't it? But you mentioned Kia's 7-year warranty. Tesla, just getting back to Tesla, have now doubled their warranty to 8 years.
They have, yeah, which is... Which is an interesting move.
It's getting to the life of a car almost.
Well, it is, yeah. Only 160,000 k's, although most people aren't going to do more than 20,000 k's in a car in a year. So, yeah, look, it's a big warranty. It's actually handy to have there, given things like the Model X, which has got the big sort of falcon wing doors that pop up very theatrically and look the business, but they don't give you a whole lot of confidence that they'll still be doing that in 3 or 4 years. And they have had issues with them overseas.
I entirely agree with you. I think they will be curious in future years.
Every time you see it come down, it sort of it looks like it's creaking and groaning and struggling to close. And they don't always. A lot of those Model X's, if you look down the car and you see the little chrome strip across at the base of the windscreen, the front door doesn't necessarily match up with the back door. So it's not, as I said, not the best fit and finish. I'm not convinced they'll still be doing that in a few years. So to have that 8-year warranty there, because that will not be cheap. If those doors go, they've got 6 sensors in each door. They've got two, they're hinged in 2 different spots so that they can open in tight car parks and so on. So they're a very, very complex item. And I hate to think how many zeros you'd be putting on the end of it to try and fix it. It'd be a big spend.
Okay, Peter, hello.
Hello. I was wondering whether these recommendations that you use premium unleaded petrol are really worth taking notice of.
So all the fuel companies will tell you that Premium Unleaded has all these detergents and extra cleaners and so on that will clean your engine. I've spoken to some mechanics who say they can tell when they take their head off an engine that that a car has been using Premium for its life. So there's some, I guess, anecdotal evidence there that there might be some truth to that. They will certainly give you better performance. So even on a basic car, you'll get an ever so slight amount of extra performance. But the biggest thing you'll notice is they'll give you a longer driving range. So they'll give you, you know, it might be 3 or 4% more per tank. So what you've got to do is then calculate, well, okay, how much more am I spending and is that worth the extra 3 or 4% range? For a lot of people, the answer will be no. The one thing to keep in mind, pretty much every European car will stipulate, and they usually say this on the inside of the fuel filler flap, it'll stipulate that it has to use Premium Unleaded, that they recommend that. One of the things with Premium Unleaded in Australia is it has a much lower sulfur content than regular unleaded. So sulfur is measured in parts per million, and the regular unleaded can go over 100 parts per million, and I think the premium's got to be less than 40 or 50 or something like that. So the higher sulfur content can cause issues with engines, particularly the more highly tuned ones. So if I had a European car, I would be using Premium Unleaded. And as I said, I'd pull out the calculator to work out whether the other one's actually giving you what it says on the box.
Well, the difference in the cost of the petrol is a lot more than 2 or 3%.
That's right. So for most people, it probably won't make a massive difference. So yeah, the answer would be no. That said, also keep in mind, so in New South Wales, for example, E10 is relatively common, and that can actually be a false economy in terms of, yes, per litre it is worth less, but you've actually got less energy in each litre of E10 than you do regular unleaded. So, E10, even though it's cheaper per litre, is not necessarily the best way to save money.
Well, I have a Lexus LS460.
Yeah,
and I've just been using regular 91 petrol, and I've never noticed any problem.
Yeah,
but I was wondering whether I'm doing the engine any harm.
So I'm not sure what Lexus stipulates. With modern Lexuses, they've got a new V6 turbo, for example, and a few other things. I'm pretty sure they do stipulate 95 or Premium Unleaded. Lexus being a Japanese brand, most of the Japanese car companies with most of their models make them so they can run on regular unleaded. There are exceptions. But I'd be checking that. But with your car, I'm almost certain you would notice a performance advantage, but it would more be at the top end of the rev range, which on a car like that, I can't imagine you use that much. I don't think you'd be revving it out to 5 or 6,000 too often. And you'd probably need a stopwatch to figure it out. So it's not going to give you a massive performance gain. But as I said, there would be something there. But the biggest gain you would notice would be in driving range and how far you get between fills. But as I said, I'd maybe do, say, 3 or 4 tanks of Premium Unleaded, monitor it pretty carefully in terms of how many kilometres you get per tank, and work out whether it's worth the extra $3, $4, $5.
Hmm. All right, Pete.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye. Joy, hello.
Hi, how you going?
Very well, thanks.
That's good. I've just been looking at the Kia Sportage Premium and just wondered what you thought about that.
Sportage is... So when the Sportage came out, that latest Sportage, it was a little bit of a game changer for Kia. It was certainly a big step up on where it had been previously. It's been a little bit overtaken in recent years. They have done some tweaks to that car, but it's been overtaken even by its sister car, Hyundai Tucson. So Hyundai and Kia being the same company. So okay. I'd put the Hyundai Tucson slightly ahead of it. Not to say you shouldn't get the Sportage, it's still a decent car, but as I said, that newer Hyundai sits on a new platform and it's a slightly better car generally. And also have a look at a Mazda CX-5. So they'd probably be the two to have a look at and just see how you think it measures up. But, in my mind, they're better cars.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah. No worries.
Cool. Enjoy. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye. We're about to see more big American trucks out here.
Yeah, we are. All done by... So none of them are coming out of the factory with the steering wheel on the right. They're all coming out left-hand drive. and getting converted in Australia, purely because it costs millions or sometimes tens of millions of dollars to engineer a car for right-hand drive. So the factories end up saying too hard. And to put the numbers in perspective, in America, they'll sell upwards of 500,000 of them. In Australia, you might sell 500 or 1,000 of them. So it's,
but how do you... Yeah, how do you... I mean, like, switching it over means you need them to make a brand new dash for you.
Oh,
you've got to move all the instruments.
The dash is the easy bit. Dash is the easy bit. It's all the stuff, so things like brake boosters and so on under the engine, where the steering column goes and how...
That's right, it would be really a massive conversion.
Massive. It's a massive problem. So a massive engineering effort to do it from scratch. So if you design a car from scratch, so... From the minute they pick up the notepad and design it, if they start then, it's a lot cheaper to engineer for right-hand drive because you're basically taking into account things like the dashboard and all that sort of stuff. But to take a car that has never been thought of as right-hand drive and say, okay, now we've got to put the steering wheel over here and the pedals and everything else, it starts to make it a lot trickier. So it's a big job, but there are a lot of companies in Australia that specialise in that, in fabricating the components and switching it over and so on. So,
but you'd have to make a brand new dash.
Yeah, I'm not sure how they do it.
You can't
turn
it upside down.
No, you can't, and you can't mirror it. So, yeah, there'd be a lot of that work trying to make sure that they get it right. But HSV, for example, is now getting into a fair bit of that. They're starting to do Chevy Camaros, and they're starting to do Chevy Silverado, so the Ute. So it's going to start, price-wise, wait for it, $115,000. So it's not cheap. And most of these are into six figures. They're expensive cars or trucks. Hmm. But another one coming out soon is the Ram 1500. So Ram is, well, again, a company associated with HSV is involved with that. And they are doing the Ram 2500 and the Ram 3500, so heavier duty versions, and they're now looking to do that smaller Ram 1500. The pricing, they haven't announced it yet, but the feeling is it might be around the $70,000 mark, so a little bit closer to the real world, but still a pretty pricey car.
Mm. Just a couple of others too. In the Ute business and the Ute market, the Ford Ranger Raptor is going to cost $75,000.
Yeah, they've announced the price. Wow. So, yeah, $74,990 plus on road. So it'll be one of the most expensive of the regular utes on the market. And the first, well, one of the first of the sort of off-roady, sports car-y type things. They've sort of added some big chunky suspension to it, done a lot of effort. It's not just stiffer springs or something. They've completely redesigned the suspension and given it a much chunkier tyres and so on. So it looks the business, and it's also promising to be pretty quick over some rough roads. So no doubt there will be some people pretty keen to get into that early on. And that's, we talked about Ford with the Australian design and engineering. That's another one that is Ford Australia.
You've talked about the Mercedes-Benz X-Class before. It's gone on sale now.
It has, yeah. So if you want a flash ute, starts at a smidge under $50,000. It's based on a Nissan Navara, which we talked about before. Yeah. It actually uses a Nissan engine.
It is a Nissan Navara.
Yeah, they have changed quite a bit, and they've actually done a good job in making it so you don't feel like you're driving a Nissan. I even popped the engine on one, and it's got proper Mercedes engine cover and so on, and Nissan engine underneath. anyone who is expecting to get a luxury vehicle will maybe a little bit disappointed.
Uh-huh.
It's really just another ute that has been done well.
Is it a bit plasticky?
Oh, the base one is. It's got vinyl floors. Okay. And it's got grey bumpers. They don't even paint the bumpers. And it's got steel wheels. So very unluxury. But Merck is saying they're expecting about two-thirds of owners to pick the top-of-the-range one called the Power. And that one's obviously a lot more expensive. You still have to option leather on that one, so it's still not standard.
Okay.
But it's got fake leather instead. But it's a nice ute. It slots somewhere into the middle of the ute segment in terms of how it performs and so on. It doesn't change the ute game other than it brings a premium brand or a luxury brand to that ute market.
Mm. Well, now, what have you been driving? You've been driving the Holden Equinox. You talked about that. You've also been driving a Mitsubishi Eclipse Cross.
Eclipse Cross, yeah, which is a, it's been selling in pretty good numbers. It's a fairly distinctively styled small to mid-sized SUV with a sort of, on the tailgate, it's almost got an extra bit of rear window under the main rear window. So it looks quite different from behind, quite upright and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But they're sort of trying to say it's a mix between a coupe and an SUV, but really it's very much SUV. It drives reasonably well, 1.5-litre turbocharged engine, so it goes okay. in terms of how it tackles corners, again, it's okay, nothing special. The interior is fairly well presented. The one issue I've got is it's got this sort of touchpad thing to select the infotainment on the main screen, and it's not the best thing in terms of making you hit the right virtual button. It sort of gets a little bit lost here and there.
But. And for fantasy, for most of us anyway, you've been driving the Maserati Ghibli S,
yeah, it's got the twin turbo V6 engine in it, so it goes fairly nicely. $200,000 though, so it's not for the faint walleted. No, that's right. And the problem it's got is you've got things like Mercedes C63s and so on, which are more affordable than that, and certainly offer similar, if not better, performance. So it's, but look, the Ghibli is a very stylish vehicle. It's very elegant inside, and it certainly drives nicely. It's just, it doesn't push any buttons much more than some of the Germans.
If you want a Maserati, that's the thing, isn't it?
That's right. Well, yeah.
And for a lot of people, that's what they want.
Good chance your neighbours won't have one.
Exactly. All right, Toby, terrific stuff as always. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.